Well, rather than capital, I feel like Chinese regulators never sleep. Over the past 9 months, Ant Group's IPO got pulled. Community group buying players were fined for price dumping. We had Alibaba. Alibaba was fined for anti-monopoly violations. We've had Meituan also fined for anti-monopoly violations. And just like Oprah dishes out cars, every tech giant seems to be getting a summons from the Chinese regulator at the moment. The big news last Friday was the Chinese government's decision to turn online education stocks into non-profits, banning them from raising capital and going public. And the sell-off across the ADRs was huge. Tencent, which influences the JSE via the Naspers stable, collapsed this week after Chinese competition authorities ordered it to stop a practice of exclusive music licensing rights, also levying a small fine, which follows similar action against other tech firms. And the value destruction in Naspers has been staggering, equaled only by the speed of the recovery this week too. So why are the regulators getting involved and in such a heavy-handed way? It's the trillion rand question for local fund managers right now, which actually puts our local unrest and vaccine issues into perspective. I'm joined now by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Michael Power, Strategist at Investec Asset Management. Warwick, tech platforms pose significant challenges to nation states and their legitimacy. They are becoming, if you look at it, de facto institutions, not just providing the utilities that are central to the lives of ordinary citizens, but they actually set the rules of the game in which society operates. You just look at Facebook. It sets the content moderation policy for one-third of the world. Twitter and others have deplatformed former President Trump, reducing him to a digital persona non grata. These are powerful private entities that are part monopoly and part public good, but consumer welfare is certainly not a core part of their agenda. So there is gradually this increasing awareness amongst lawmakers, which is why governments on three continents are actually reassessing the impact and the reach that tech giants have on their citizens. The tech lash is certainly global. And if we look looking back a year from now, if we see US tech stocks crashing, won't we look back and say the writing was actually on the wall? How could we be so blind? Isn't China actually doing everything that America and Europe should be doing?
Well, Michael, I think they're certainly doing perhaps what other nation states might want to do. I mean, the question you've asked is actually, it's quite multifaceted. There's a few issues here. The first is that, as you quite rightly point out, I mean, the likes of Facebook and Twitter and so on pretty much spit at border posts. They quite clearly are international. They are not dependent on any particular currency. They do, on the other hand, perhaps have to consider a multiple of different nationalities and the values of those nationalities, whether it's political or morality or so on and so forth. But the other point is that the whole nature of tech tends to result in a few big winners. I mean, you know, when fund managers talk about scalable businesses, well, tech businesses, and particularly broad distribution tech businesses, are the ultimate scalable businesses. And that's both good and bad. I mean, it means that you have a platform that is highly efficient in doing what it does. But it also means that there's literally one or two winner takes all. And that means that the resultant winners are potentially very powerful companies indeed with very wide reach. And we see that with the likes of Facebook, Twitter, etc. I mean, think of the Arab Spring, for example. I mean, Twitter basically facilitated revolutions in five different nation states. No wonder number of nation states are twitchy. And I think what is particularly interesting, of course, is that the Chinese, having very much let the tech companies be a kind of a wild west, and I mean, if you think of all of those big tech companies, they actually, I mean, a lot of them have post box addresses in the likes of Grand Cayman and so on. But they've become very powerful, and they've actually become leaders as opposed to followers of US tech. So this is uncharted water.
And that's why it's such an important question, Michael, to bring you in, for markets to understand the context within which this regulatory conversation takes place in China. And I'm reminded of Deng's slogan of crossing the river slowly by feeling the stones. It's sort of this pragmatism that we need to feel our way through these new worlds. What do you make of the way that the Chinese have been approaching tech regulation? What do you see as the major driving forces here?
Well, I think we've fallen into the trap of assuming that tech is as the Americans define it. In other words, it's very oriented towards the consumer, which is the named companies of Facebook, Twitter, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple. They're very consumer oriented. What China has reminded us in the last couple of weeks is that tech is not all about the consumer. It's about production tech as well. And their priority has been to shift the marginal renminbi away from multi-angle camera TikTok cat videos to something which is a little bit more industrial. And I noted this morning that CATL, which is the largest battery manufacturer in the world, a Chinese, close to 50% market share of all batteries or lithium-ion batteries, has this morning come out with a sodium-ion battery, which is revolutionary in that it has no lithium in it, no cobalt, no nickel. Yet it hasn't received a mention very much unless you look very hard on the airwaves. So what China wants is more chips and less cat videos. And they're trying to redefine and re-emphasize that there's a lot more to tech than that which is consumer-oriented. Now, the United States, 72% of GDP is consumption. So it's not surprising that tech has geared itself towards that aspect. And what China is going to do over the next few years is to re-emphasize, let's just say, the production side of tech. And that's where we're seeing the marginal emphasis now being placed. This is causing a certain amount of turbulence as this re-emphasis takes place, and we're caught up in the middle of it at the moment.
Fascinating that we don't need more cat videos. I can agree on that point, Raymond. What do you make of the market's reaction to the Chinese tech tantrum, if you want to call it that, this week?
Build on what has been said by looking perhaps in the longer term about the wider institutional questions which could arise for all companies doing business in China, whether it's from South Africa or elsewhere. Yes, on the tech rules of the game, I think that my colleagues have had more to say than I can offer. I'm interested in the longer term, and I think many other businesses who are involved in the Chinese economy should also apply themselves to the status around the rule of law in China. Now, we must understand that the great success they've had over the past few decades has come without a formal rule of law. It has been the assurance of the Chinese Communist government that they will create a favorable environment for investors, both domestic and of course foreign. And increasingly we've seen the foreign involvement in the Chinese economy. Now that's been adequate to bring the Chinese economy to where it is now. But as you begin to shift the rules of the game, you've got to ask yourself, well, is the rule of law applicable in China to the extent that, well, if you don't like what the regulator has done, you can go to the constitutional court in China. There is no constitutional court in China. In other words, that the Chinese government, in the implementation of its policies and its regulations, does not accept the authority of any other institution as being superior to its own sovereign decision-making. So I think what's important in the longer term, as we see how the Chinese decision makers are handling these issues, especially where they want to tighten screws, the fact remains that there is no appeal. There is no rule. You can't go to the Cape Western Court and say, look, will you please review this regulation because it offends the constitution. There is only one constitution in China, and that is the Chinese government. So I just think we need, whatever the merits of the technical issues here, we need to say, just bear in mind that as things change in China, they could be very arbitrary and they could be very uncertain. And I think that's an important risk factor just to bear in mind in what is otherwise a very profitable and developing market.
And it is a point that has been raised around the variable interest entity structure, the VIE structure. Michael, what do you make of that, that risk around a recourse to an international court or a local court if you're unhappy with a particular decision and the rule of law in China?
Look, I think the VIE, just to go to your first point, was an accommodation in the early stages of the process of the internationalization of Chinese capital. And at that stage, they were happy to take certain companies to New York, and as we know, many of them went through the VIE structure. I think the Chinese government has now decided that they want to essentially, the chickens must come home to roost now, but they must roost in Hong Kong. And once they're all back, all the big ones are back in Hong Kong, my suspicion is the VIE structure will disappear, and foreigners will actually be allowed to own directly into Chinese companies. The only issue there is that they will do so through the medium of the Hong Kong Stock Exchange rules, which ultimately is subject to Chinese rules. So they will formalize it, VIE will disappear, and it will become much cleaner, but subject to the fact that it's not, you can't take the issue to the Cayman Island court, as you probably could with the VIE structure. It's ultimately going to be subject to Chinese law and Chinese law alone. And I think that's where we're all heading with all of these structures.
Warwick, I think I'm positive long term about the outlook for China, because a dead company is no good to anyone, and I'm sure the Chinese Communist Party understand that. They're trying to redraw the boundaries, the regulatory boundaries within which private companies operate, but they certainly don't want to kill the golden goose. Do you think there's a significant value to be had in the market right now with the way we've seen tech sell off 15-20% if you look back to what happened in 2018. We had a similar sell-off when the gaming regulations were introduced, a very quick drawdown, but then also a very quick recovery. If you had bought at that time when everyone was heading for the exits, you would be smiling today.
So, Michael, look, I think one has to take a view as to what are the motivations here, and I think we've touched on that to some degree. I mean, remember, of course, at the end of the day, politics is run by politicians, and particularly unconstrained ones in China. And one of the most valuable assets that their tech giants have are incredibly large lists of both their own people and, for that matter, assorted foreigners. So I think that they want to have a firmer hand in controlling that data. And as you say, they wouldn't want to kill the golden goose that holds all of that data. So I think that In a reasonable period of time, I think that this whole wave will I think level off, and yes, I think with the benefit of hindsight, it probably will prove to be some kind of opportunity, as long as the Chinese product doesn't get excessively tainted by the state intervention. So there's an important caveat, I feel.
Well, Finance Minister Tito Mboweni has now given further details on the various economic relief and fiscal support measures, some 36 billion rands worth outlined by the President last Sunday to deal with the riots and the recent events. How do they stack up in relation to the widespread losses that were suffered? Raymond, overall, is it enough? I mean, we've got the introduction of the social relief of distress grant again. Many are worried that this now portends the introduction of a permanent basic income grant. We've got some insurance support, some employment tax incentives. Taken together, is it enough?
I think all of us must accept that steering this path, this very difficult path between lives and livelihoods, is a very difficult one, whether in South Africa or indeed elsewhere. So I think when we look at the package that was outlined by the Minister of Finance, it's clear now that, in fact, the headlines are more about what to do about the economy rather than what the latest figures have been on the deaths and the infections from the pandemic. And I think it's important that we focus on this, because what you've been faced with now And if you unpack what was said by the Minister of Finance of the National Treasury this week, it's the fiscal trilemma, as I call it. It's the tax revenues, it's the government spending, and it's debt. And on all those counts, one can tick the boxes for now. In other words, that our tax revenues are up, largely because of the commodity boom. Secondly, there's still a commitment to consolidate spending by government by finding these funds elsewhere in the existing fiscal framework. And thirdly, a commitment to say we do not want to worsen our debt situation. So I think that trilemma, if I can put it that way, the fiscal trilemma, is being well managed for now. But I think what we need to understand are two points. First is that it was said by one of the National Treasury persons at the media conference that we must look further than March for what has been promised now. That's very important. And what lies beyond March is clear evidence that we are implementing the growth reforms that will give us better tax revenues in future. The second is, of course, the capacity to implement what we've said in terms of the economic relief. I'll be happy. It doesn't have to be a gold medal. I'll settle for a bronze one in delivery if we can show that over the next few months. And then finally, we need to understand that this message really was there is no free lunch. There is no free lunch, and we need to manage it over the next year or so in such a way that we get the growth and that indeed the solutions, as is often said, are hidden in plain sight. And so when we get to the medium-term budget policy statement, which is sooner in October, we must be able to send out a message that we have handled the fiscal trilemma successfully and that we can build on that, because what we then need is the private capital formation, the job creation. I mean, I said to you earlier, we could either see the third quarter as a speed hump, and we will resume our performance thereafter, perhaps averaging out at about 4% this year. But in terms of employment, it's a sinkhole.
Yeah, but chatting,
and we need to address those.
I mean, listening to Fani Titi, Michael, and he reiterates a very good point. It's about often how you respond to a crisis. In business, it's the response that really matters. And it did take the government some time to get its hands around the unrest. It looked very much for a while there that it was a state without control, a very weakened state. And now we have this suite of measures that is effectively eating the good fortune that we had with the commodity cycle, building up our fiscal reserves. What do you make of the package, firstly, and our ability to now start delivering on those much vaunted reforms?
I think the package is, broadly speaking, as was said before, I'm not going to add anything to it. It was necessary, and the fire has been put out, and some of the immediate damage done by the fire needs to be rectified. But I don't think we've heard a single new idea as to what we're going to do about 40% unemployment and 70% youth unemployment. Those figures are off the charts. Do remember that in the Great Depression in the United States, unemployment got to a maximum of 25%. We're at 40 for the country and 70 for the youth. We need to consider something a lot more fundamental in terms of reforming the economy than we're hearing at the moment. And I'm all ears, but thus far my ears are not hearing anything.
Michael, I want to stay with you for a second longer. What would be fundamental in your eyes? What could we do given our current situation? Because what we are also seeing is other governments and the IMF and the World Bank saying, in response to the COVID pandemic, you really have to stimulate your economy. And even if it means raising debt, you can get growth growing fast enough to equal out that debt-to-GDP ratio, because it is all about the denominator at the end of the day. We seem to still be fairly conservative in our approach.
I would agree. I think we need to, as I say, think radically. We need to think about which countries in the world are generating jobs and growth. I was much taken by the statistic that earlier this year Bangladesh overtook India in terms of GDP per capita, which is an extraordinary thing because when they broke away from West Pakistan, they were the weakest of all three countries, and now they have a GDP capita that's stronger than the other two. So what is it that they've been doing? And ultimately, in their particular instance, it comes down to essentially the textiles industry, the textiles for exports industry. So we need to think about what we can do as a nation, as is now being done to a degree in Ethiopia and Kenya, in order to essentially emulate, but with our own particular version of that emulation, the miracles that have been performed in Asia.
And Warwick, Raymond, I just want to come to Warwick first. An idea, Warwick, is around business process outsourcing. It's been put on the table that we could see significant job growth in business process outsourcing. Geographically, we're very aligned with the European markets. Our currency gives us a competitive advantage. We do have a base level of skills that we can rapidly absorb into that. But a few other things need to happen before we can unlock that growth. Are you seeing enough from where you're sitting from this current administration, enough urgency?
No. Very simply, something like business process outsourcing is somewhat cyclical, and it's also a somewhat mercenary business in that you need to up and down your staff levels with your amount of trade. And of course, the tight labor environment that South Africa offers is a disincentive to something like business process outsourcing. It could create a lot of jobs, but we also have to have an environment that will tolerate volatility in employment levels.
Raymond, you were going to comment?
You know, one hopes that by the time we get to the so-called mini-budget in October, the jaws of that big hippo will start to close for all the good reasons, not for any other reasons. And the important point here is what has been stressed, that it's the remedies and the reform that will rebuild investor confidence from now on. That's tremendously important, and we need to demonstrate the necessary leadership and the implementation. That's a very old story, but this delay is costing us a lot more in the background of the events of the last few weeks. So I think the important issue now is, if we do have an economic reconstruction and recovery program, let it be visible and let's try and win a gold medal with it.
Well, right now we're more like the Blitzbox being knocked out in the quarterfinals when we should be at least ending up on the podium. And Michael, I want to come back to an easy win. The amending of Schedule 2 to lift self-generation to 100 megawatts in this country was announced well over a month ago now. The President gave a 60-day deadline for that to be gazetted. We're still sitting waiting in an environment where we've had civil unrest, social unrest, a pandemic, every single reason to move with speed and haste. Again, we sit with a minister who doesn't seem to either want to move or is clearly being moved by other vested interests. Surely it's time to shake up that cabinet now, Michael.
I think that we may see the cabinet shaken up for that and other reasons in the not too distant future. I think they're just dealing with the immediate aftermath of what happened in KZN and Gauteng. But I think you're absolutely right. I am very encouraged, incidentally, by this willingness to allow alternative sources of energy to be fed into the South African system.
We just need to move with requisite speed so we start unlocking a lot of that potential capital that is sitting on the sidelines while our mining companies are printing record profits. Amplats this week, Anglo's, all of them paying record dividends and wanting now to reinvest for their future sustainability to decarbonize their own organizations. But they can't do it unless you've got the enabling regulatory environment, which is bringing us all the way back to the beginning of our conversation and what China is trying to do in terms of leveling its industry and playing fields. Well, that's all we have time for this week, putting another eventful week into perspective with Michael Power, Raymond Parsons and Warwick Lucas. Have a great weekend.